Exactly right. And you actually hit on two key concepts there. Thank you. You hit on two key concepts there. And I want to hear if maybe someone else can kind of elaborate on that. Can you say your definition again? Just so that we can...
Word for word.
It isn't the absence of fear. That's kind of, I think, a common misconception. But rather doing what you need to in face of fear.
Exactly. So the two concepts that he mentions there are, in order for courage to exist at all, there needs to be risk or kind of fear, what he was saying. Without that risk factor there, whatever you're doing won't really be considered courageous. But you could be doing risky things all day long, but you still wouldn't be considered courageous. You could run off a cliff if you wanted to, but that would be kind of more stupid than courageous. Like what you were saying, it's doing the right thing in the face of danger. And combining those two things together is how we get courage. So doing the right thing in the face of danger, or, and another way of saying it, is preserving your moral/mental strength through trials or danger. So now that we know what courage is, let's see how Joshua holds up to that definition. So the first thing I want to do is start by looking at Joshua, the man, outside of Joshua, the book. Because there's actually quite a few pieces where Joshua is mentioned outside of his own book. So the first thing I want to check out is what Joshua was doing before he took command of the Israelites. So what was Joshua before he was the leader when Moses was still around? Who was he and what was he doing? He was a spy, yes. He was one of the 12 spies, but that actually wasn't the first time we see him.
He was Moses' attendant.
Yes. Yes, his protege, Moses' second in command. And typically, what comes with being second in command? Yes, a massive amount of responsibility. And I would say that a lot of the dirty work actually kind of falls to the second in command to take care of. Well, I'm not giving any discredit to Moses. But, you know, he makes the high level decisions, but Joshua, or the second in command in general, is the one who carries it out. And with being second in command means that Moses also had extreme loyalty and trust in Joshua, because the second in command has a lot of responsibility. And the first time we actually ever see Joshua, and I want to highlight his, the trust that Moses and Joshua shared, is in Exodus chapter 17. If you guys want to turn there, I'm going to have one of you guys, read an excerpt from there. That's Exodus chapter 17, and we're going to be starting in verse 8. And once someone is there, you can raise your hand and say, but I want someone to read Exodus 17, starting in verse 8 and going through verse 16. So that's Exodus 17, verse 8 through 16. Who wants to read that? Shannon, go ahead.
Then Amalek came and bought Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men to go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek. And while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill, whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put them under him. And he sat on it while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called it the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of the God of the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.
Excellent. Thank you, Shannon. So I think I already said this, but this is the first time we see Joshua in the Bible. And it is when Moses commands Joshua to lead their armies against the people of Amalek. So let's see here. Notice verse 10, where it says, Joshua did as Moses told him and fought Amalek. I know the topic for today is Joshua's courage, but I believe this passage also shows Joshua's great faithfulness, not only in Moses, but also in God. And I kind of wanted to bring up a question here, which, because I actually stumbled across this a lot when researching Joshua. How can courage and faithfulness be connected? How would you be able to kind of combine the two to maybe, I don't know, be about the same thing? If that's too much of a out there question, you can tell me. But yeah, how would you combine, or how can faithfulness and courage be connected? Anyone got any ideas?
Great question.
Thank you. Sabrina?
I think courage or faith, they can pull each other. Have courage to be faith. Even God and the bravery, or you can be courage to be faith, vice versa. I think of Abraham with that as well, because he had faith. He had the courage to fulfill what God asked him to do with Isaac.
Excellent answer. Thank you. Let's see. Okay. And then also in verse 14, we see that, God told Moses to recite to, Joshua what Moses was writing down. Why do you think that the Bible mentions that God told Moses this? In verse 14, Lord told Moses to, recite in the ears of, Joshua. Why do you think the Bible makes note of this?
Joshua is going to take the place of Moses when he dies, that, you know, he's going to be carrying on these commands that,
yes,
will happen in the future, you know, that he will need to preserve and keep in the ears of the people.
Exactly. Yeah, I have written down, the Bible doesn't explicitly say here that the role would be Joshua's one day, because, like I said, this is the first time we see Joshua, but God does know what is to become of Joshua at this point. So God's making sure that Joshua knows what's going on so that he can assume that role one day. And then finally, in this this last question for this section in Exodus 17, so how does this whole event exemplify Joshua's courage? What actions has he done here to show that he is a courageous person? Yes, Shannon?
I think verse 10, so Joshua did as Moses told
him. Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, he was the one that was going out to battle.
Exactly. Right, and so battle's not a pretty thing.
Right. He's the one that's going up against the army. Moses is standing, you know, back.
Right.
Right, and it's like, well, Moses had the easy job in some ways.
Yes, he did. He only had to stick up his hands. no, it was a team effort for sure. I don't want anyone getting the wrong idea, but yes, you're right. Joshua was the one that actually went out there and got some killing done, which is not pretty. Okay, anything else anyone wants to point out from Exodus 17 before we move on?
It makes me wonder. We've already seen in our Exodus class that God did not take them the way that they would normally go to the land of Canaan, because unless they saw war and would turn around. So they had been a slave people, and yet, you know, this is the first instance of someone, you know, facing this really big fear and a really big job, and he had to. Evidently, he was the leader. He had the courage and the faith in God to go ahead and pursue it. So it's the first time this had been shown that he can be that to these people.
Right.
And he had to show them he was trusting in the little people.
Right. All right. Good point.
But look, a little side point here is when he expresses about Amalek before Joshua and write it down, God is making a prophecy of what will happen. And in Isaiah 30, verse 8, you see, you know, he tells us that you write this down. For testimony, I said it, I thought it about. And so here you have the confirmation of Joshua and others here. Clearly, it's been written down, and God eventually will fulfill it over for Samuel. So that process is
reflected. Excellent points. Okay. So my next section for Joshua outside of Joshua is what was brought up earlier about how the 12 spies went to go check out the land of Canaan before they were exiled until the next generation. Well, this is actually the event that caused it. But so we want to turn to Numbers 13. We're going to be looking at Numbers 13 and 14. So I say here, so Joshua, at this point, he's already established he's a good military leader. But now we can see that he's also pretty good at reconnaissance and being able to be sneaky, I guess, in a word. And something interesting here is that Joshua, that wasn't actually always his name. Can anyone tell me what his name used to be before Joshua? How do you pronounce it? Hosea. That's interesting. I always thought of it as Hosea, but it can probably be read either way. And we can see that Moses is the one that changed his name from Hosea to Joshua in verse 16. So Numbers 13, verse 16. These were the names of the men who Moses sent to spy out the land. And Moses called called Hosea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Now, Hosea means something like salvation, while Joshua means something like Yahweh saves. Can anyone tell me why Yahweh saves would be a very important lesson for Joshua to know in his life going forward?
God's got his back.
Exactly. As we can see, throughout pretty much the rest of Joshua's life, most, if not all, of his successes can be because God was always there for him and had its back. So if your name is literally Yahweh saves, that's a great reminder all the time that God is the one that's there for you, not yourself. So that's probably why his name was changed to Joshua, why Moses changed his name to that. All right. Now skipping over to chapter 14. Well, actually, so can someone give me a brief summary of what exactly went down in chapter 13, as to why, or what did the spies come back with, and who were the two people that gave a good report, and what were the rest of them saying?
I think it was consensus that the land was a premium location.
Yes.
Everything about it was nice, but the difference in opinion was that Joshua and Caleb were certain they could take the people, and were not so certain that they did.
Right, because the inhabitants were super big and scary. And I know I may kind of lie to that, but, you know, just imagine having to fight somebody that you had to look up to try to fight. That would definitely be intimidating. But Joshua and Caleb remembered that even though the people were this big, God was even bigger than that. So who wants to read verses 1 through 10 of Numbers chapter 14? So it's Numbers 14, verses 1 through 10. Who wants to read that?
Then all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried. And the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will be plundered. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us appoint the leader and reign in Egypt. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation. Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, the land which we passed through to spy out is exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. But all the congregation said, to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of the meeting to all the sons of Israel.
All right, thank you. All right, so yes, we can see here that Joshua and Caleb are sticking up for their faith. And we can actually see here, well, actually, I want someone else to point this out. What were the people of Israel going to do to Joshua and Caleb? Yeah, they were going to kill him for sticking up to their to what they knew was right. So kind of obvious question here, but how was Joshua's courage exemplified in this passage? What exactly happened that showed that Joshua was courageous?
Not only did he stand up to a lot of Israelites, not just one, it sounds like, he stood up to a mob and said, we can do it, but he also identified the source of what would allow them to do it. If the Lord is pleased with them, then he will remove their protection and give victory to them.
Exactly. And that's a very important point to make, that as long as you're pleasing God, you can do anything, but you have to make sure you're doing what God has told you to in order to receive his blessing. That's always been the caveat. But yeah, so anything else we want to point out in Numbers 14 and 13 before moving on? Sabrina?
I was going to say something that I've noticed in going over this again is that Joshua does show that he's notifying that God knows, we can us, it was the first piece of him. I think that's a really good role model for, you know, going forward. You know, if you have that good level of support, you can.
Excellent point. I think I heard someone else over here.
Yeah. Maybe to kind of put it in different terms, you know, expressing courage the way that God defines it is oftentimes not going to be the popular opinion that we see about the case here. But despite the fact that Caleb and Joshua knew that they were alone in their point of view on this, in the sense that the other spies didn't agree, which, you know, wasn't really that important. You know, they still came with this report that, listen, we can do this. And, you know, hopefully people are, we won't kill us.
Right.
So, you know, oftentimes we're going to be faced with decisions that aren't going to be the popular view. It doesn't mean it's not the right thing to do.
Exactly.
That's what makes it courageous to do it.
The majority is not always the correct answer.
I can, you know, in a spiritual sense, we're always going to be in the minority.
Right.
And I think just having that kind of perspective going into the situation is going to be helpful for us. Knowing that at some point we're going to have to go it alone, or, you know, with very few people by ourselves.
Right. Shannon?
Yeah, I think, you know, contrasting Joshua to the people that he's dealing with, they obviously have a lack of courage, and Joshua is trying to encourage them. Twice he says, do not fear the people of the land, in verse 9, and then again in verse 9, do not fear them, right? Like, what was preventing them from going forward, taking the action? It's pretty clear that it was fear.
Right. Because fear shows a lack of faith in God. Because if you actually believed in God, you would have nothing to fear. And excellent.
Sorry, I just want to, because this is something I struggle with a lot. I have, it's not clinically diagnosed, but I'm certain if I went to a doctor and told about it, I was thinking of problems. Anxiety is a thing for me. Like, I like to worry about the smallest things sometimes. People can get caught them all in the head about the situation. And that always creates a lot of tension internally for me, because scriptures tell us, don't be anxious about anything. Oh man, I must not be a very good Christian here, because here I am constantly worrying about, you know, all these minor things. And you know, I don't think in kind of putting the context of fear, because I'd imagine there are others who share my plight, which is, you know, you just have to be able to overcome kind of these mental obstacles, these barriers that we create for ourselves. So it's not so much that we can't be afraid, but we can't let that cripple us.
Right.
Right? Where that just kind of disables you and you're not able to move forward, that's where it becomes a problem. And that's where we have to be able to take a moment to just kind of reflect and really kind of center ourselves on what is important, and that is that God's got our back. The same way they had it for Joshua and Moses and everybody else that we read about, you know, as we've gone through this study. And being able to just take a moment and kind of clear our mind and come back to that very point so that we can be courageous, so that we
right.
can demonstrate.
And we, you know, we all have our own individual issues. But I think what's important to God is when we pick ourselves up and just try to keep on pressing forward. Well, yeah.
I'm going to find the wrong in verse 11. It God is displeased with the people because they spurned God. It says, despite all the signs, the plagues have taken place, the Red Sea, all that, God has demonstrated his power and says, I will take care of my people. Now think about us. Think about all the wonders and the signs that Jesus did. God raised him from the dead, the testimony to all men until the day of judgment. God has said, I am here. You're my people. Go where I tell you to go. So your point's really, really powerful here. We need that courage.
Thank you, sir. Good point yourself. And this one final thing I want to mention is I always like to give props to Caleb in this story as well, because it's always easier to go through things like this when you have someone there with you. That's standing right by your side. I'm sure Joshua would have been able to stick to his guns all by himself, but I'm sure Caleb being there helped him out. Okay, so that's kind of all I wanted to touch on for Joshua outside of Joshua. I kind of want to – you don't have to turn to Joshua just yet. You can if you want to. I do have maybe a few other passages. I have a section on Moses here. I may just skip that. But so I want us to start looking at the timeline at the start of Joshua. So where are we at the start of Joshua? What's been happening, and who have kind of been the main characters?
Wandering.
Yes. The wandering happened from what?
Well, not too long after and seeing we were just looking
exactly.
At, yeah.
Yep. Okay. So the Israelites have just got finished wandering through the wilderness because of the story we just got finished reading in Numbers 13 and 14. How, and then I said I was going to skip over Moses, but just real quick, does anyone know how old Moses was when he died in the plains of Moab? Off the top of their head? Yes. Moses was 120 years old when he died in the plains of Moab. And something else to point out here, what were they waiting on before they could get into the land of Canaan?
Ubiquity of the Amorite.
What was that?
The ubiquity of the Amorite.
Yes. Okay, awesome. Okay, having to skip a section here. Okay, who wrote Joshua? Does anyone know? If not, that's okay, because the answer is we don't know. yep. But the best guess is that Joshua wrote most of it, and at least one other person did after Joshua's death. But the answer is we don't really know. That's just speculation, so I wouldn't bet everything on that. But okay, so the purpose of the book of Joshua. We're going to see three main lessons from it today. Lesson number one is that God's promises are conditioned upon man's obedience. You can see, we will see great success from the Israelites in the book of Joshua when they follow God and do exactly as he says. And then not so much when they deviate from his word. They start losing and they start losing courage immediately. Lesson number two is that great things can be accomplished if one follows God. This generation of Israelites that we're going to read in Joshua, at the start of Joshua, was one of the most faithful to God ever that we see in the Bible. And it definitely shows. Their military conquest across the land of Canaan is something unparalleled to anything else we see in human history. And then the final lesson is the lesson of fear. The Israelites were to fear God and not man. I know we were saying before that we brought that up as well, that if you fear the wrong things, it's going to hurt you in the end. Okay, and then the book is split up into three sections as well. Chapters 1 through 12 are more dealing with entering and conquering the promised land. Chapters 13 through 22 are instructions for distributing and the portioning of the promised land. And then chapters 23 and 24 is Joshua's farewell address. And we'll stay focused on more chapters 1 through 12 because that's where most of the action is taking place and that's also where most of the courage is taking place. So I know I said you didn't have to turn to Joshua just yet before, but I lied. Let's go ahead and turn to Joshua. Okay. So, I have this first section of Joshua, part one of Joshua, God's charge to Joshua, a lot of Joshua, in parentheses, it's showtime. Finally, we're entering the promised land after all this time. We're going to be sticking to chapter 1, verses 1 through 9 for our first little section. I'll go ahead and read verses 1 through 2. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, unto the people of Israel. Okay, so can anyone just tell me what is happening from these first two verses that I read? What is going on right now? Yep. And who's speaking to Joshua? God, yes. Now, I'm not entirely sure. I wasn't able to see anything else about this, but does anyone else know? Is this the first time God has spoken to Joshua directly? I'm not entirely sure. It may be. Maybe God was just speaking to Moses directly before this, just speaking directly to the main leader of Israel. So I can imagine this is a big moment for Joshua. You know, it's finally time. The torch is being passed to me. And so to go along with that, that's some pretty big shoes to fill, isn't it? I mean, Moses, he was the top dog for a long time. And even though Joshua is no stranger to command, he's been second in command for a while. It's a big step to go to that next level and take over the leadership of everybody. And I also just want to point out that we can see here that God's promise to Israel has not changed simply because Moses died. You know, his promise is going to stay consistent. He's just going to use whoever is available. That's always how it's been. And then also I want to point out that three times in verses 1-9 in chapter 1, God commands Joshua to be strong and courageous. Verse 6, 7, and 9. To kind of go along with this theming of courageousness, God's also reminding Joshua of that as he takes command. So why do you think he said it to him so many times? I mean, Joshua's already been pretty courageous to this point. Why three separate times in so short of a scripture? Any guesses? Yeah.
I don't know. But my hunch is that it's easier to be courageous when you are not the head honcho, but when you're in charge of, when you are responsible for an entire nation of people, I think you need an extra dose of courage.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's not. No, I mean, that's definitely a good guess. Let's see, what do I... Yeah, so my answer was God knows they're about to enter to a great conquest filled with dangers and daunting enemies. And he just wanted to remind Joshua that his courage hasn't been unfounded. Like, so up until this point, they've definitely had hardships, but like the 10 spies that were too afraid to go into the promised land, these people are scary. And even though they're right on the doorstep, God's just reminding Joshua, hey, don't lose faith now. You're here. You can do it. Okay. That was a good answer as well. They didn't want to make light of that. Okay, so part two of Joshua, crossing the Jordan. This is always an interesting passage to me. I kind of forget about this one, but the Red Sea wasn't the only time that the Israelites crossed a body of water. I believe this was definitely done this way by God to remind the Israelites of what Moses did and what his power was. Just kind of being like, just, you know how I got you away from those Egyptians this way? Well, I'm also getting you into the promised land this way as well. Just a very potent reminder, which actually, let's see. We're looking in chapter 3, and I believe God actually explains this in verse 7. Yeah, the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And that's the main reason. Well, maybe not the main reason, but that's why they crossed the Jordan the way they did, so that everyone knew that God was still with them. All right, so chapter 3, who wants to read verses 7-9? I know I already read one of them, but it wouldn't hurt to read it again. Who wants to read 7-9?
The Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you inside of all Israel, so that they will know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. So you shall command the priests who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, saying, when you come to the edge of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. Then Joshua said to the sons of Israel, come here and hear the words of the Lord your God.
Awesome. Joshua then commands the people of Israel as God instructed him. He tells them how they're supposed to cross, which exemplifies Joshua's faithfulness here by just doing exactly as God commanded him. All right, who wants to read verses 14-17?
So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant before the people, as soon as those bearing the Ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the Ark were dipped in the brink of the water, now the Jordan overflowed all the tents throughout the time of the harvest. The waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far away, at Adam, the city that is beside Zarephath, and those flowing down toward the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. And the people passed over opposite Jericho. Now the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan.
Excellent. Okay, who wants to, I noticed something kind of interesting with this one, which I think kind of makes this act of crossing a body of water more courageous than the Red Sea. Who wants to take a stab at what that would be? Why would this one be more courageous than the crossing of the Red Sea?
Describes this river kind of as a rushing, like a rushing water. A sea is kind of falling, but this one seems to be rushing and overflowing.
No, that's a good point. I actually didn't think about that, but yes, this water is probably more flowing. Probably seems a little bit more immediately dangerous. The thing I thought of was that they're not being chased by an army this time. They were kind of spurred by fear when crossing the Red Sea. But in this case, the children of Israel, they didn't have anybody chasing them. They went in of their own volition this time. It was all on their choice. And I thought that probably required a bit more courage, not being kicked along by a Russian army. So that was crossing the Jordan. Does anyone have anything else they want to point out about this section of Joshua? If not, that's okay. Going once, going twice. All right. Part three of Joshua, Jericho. So we just got finished crossing the Jordan. There's a few different things that happen before we get to Jericho, but we're going to go ahead and skip over that and go ahead and move on to chapter six. I've had a bunch of people reading, so I'll go ahead and read a little bit. I'm going to read chapter 6, verses 1 through 7. Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days. Seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the seventh day, you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, everyone straight before him." So Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord." And he said to the people, "Go forward, march around the city, and let the armed men pass on before the Ark of the Lord." So, notice verse 1. Why were the people of Jericho afraid of the Israelites? Sabrina?
Well, from what we see of Rahab, she had heard more.
Yes.
So there's no doubt that the Israelites were quite popular. There's no word left out. So, they're probably
willing to. No, you're right. And that was actually my answer. In chapter 2, verses 8 through 9 of Joshua, Rahab answers the question. Apparently, God's promise to the Israelites was well-known and popular, and everyone around the land knew it. And then notice verse 2. Why did God phrase it so that it sounds like Jericho was already taken? Why was it phrased this way? Exactly. Simply put, God can say what he wants because he can make it happen. After God's instruction, Joshua then goes and relays them to the people, doing as he was told. Then the people of Israel do exactly as God commanded, which is pretty refreshing to see. I already wrote that down. I guess I memorized my notes. And then chapter 6, verses 20 through 21. So the people shouted and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. Then they devoted all in the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys, with the edge of the sword. So I'm going to play devil's advocate here a little bit, but you can imagine that the taking of Jericho could not be described any other way than a slaughter. I thought God was supposed to be loving and compassionate. Why would he allow this amount of bloodshed and slaughter happen? I can even imagine innocent children being caught up in this. How can one justify this?
It helps to remember that God had given them 430 years to change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they spurned that over and over so that their iniquity was good. And the children, by what we understand that the scriptures would be saved, because they would be innocent, but those who were guilty
would be sorrowful. Right. And you can also see if these people were willing to admit who the true God was, such as Rahab, God is willing to spare these people, but they need to be willing to admit who the true God is. And in Deuteronomy chapter 20, 16 through 18, I just have a little excerpt here. The Bible does say the reason for all this. And it says that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods. And so you sin against the Lord your God. That is why they're to go through and wipe everybody out so that they are not infected by what they are doing. And like I said, though, kind of going another layer deeper, I'm sure some of the kids in Jericho were innocent. Why did they die for the sins of others? I can only imagine that there were some innocent kids in that city. I may be wrong, but just playing devil's advocate here. Who wants to try to take a stab at that? That's okay. My answer here, I have in Deuteronomy 13:6. I have a typo there, so I'm just going to go with 13:6. So, if your brother, the son of your mother, or your son or your daughter, or the wife you embrace, or your friend who is as your own soul entices you secretly, saying, "Let us go and serve other gods which neither you nor your fathers have known, some of the gods of the people who are around you, or whether near you or far off from you, from the one to end of the earth to the other, you shall not yield to him or listen to him, nor shall your eye pity him, nor shall you spare him, nor shall you conceal him, but you shall kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death." So essentially what we're seeing here is that no one is spared if these things occur. You know, the act of doing this is terribly wicked. And at the end of the day, it is not God's fault that these people were so wicked. It is what needed to happen because God said it needed to be this way. And at the end of the day, that's all that really matters. That's how it needed to happen. So I know those were kind of tough questions, but I did want to touch on them because, you know, sometimes it's good to challenge ourselves in that way with those questions.
Now, you mentioned in Genesis 15:16, God told Abraham that he would give him this promised land, but the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full.
Yeah, you were saying that earlier, right?
When you get to Leviticus chapter 18, God describes just how putridly wicked they were. Mm-hmm. And he warns his people, if you go that way, I will spew you out of the land also. The other thing is children that are still young enough to not sin, even though it's a difficult thing about the physical life being taken, their souls are given to God. And so,
right,
you know, because of their innocence.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, too. And we just need to remember that this is not God being horribly violent. This is just how disgusting sin is. And the measures that God needs to take against sin sometimes.
Just want to take a second to point out that this was God's plan for the Israelites in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something he is telling.
Right. Exactly.
I don't have great answers for why he did what he did. Or I don't have an answer that people will like for leaving the people that he did in the Old Testament. And the New Testament here commanded in Romans chapter 12 to, as far as it depends on us, the people that we call them. That's what we are operating under.
Right. Yes, excellent point, everybody. Okay, so in the taking of Jericho, how can we see Joshua's courage exemplified in this chapter? I know it's like beating a dead horse, but I just like to stick with the theming.
He led God's people, and what would have, you know, from the human perspective, seemed like, you know, think of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And him knowing that God was with him and his people, he was willing to stand up despite the fears, I'm sure, that they had, knowing that God was giving them.
Exactly. Shannon, did you have a point?
Oh, I was just thinking that I always looked at it more being an act, you know, this act of faith more than an act of courage, you know, where, you know, God is asking people to do something that, why do you want us to march around the city? You know, it's like, how does that even, you know, like, we're wasting our energy. We need to be getting ready for, you know, battle. And it's like, why are we doing this? And it's like, well, that trust, that faith in God that says, yeah, if we do this, this will come out all right. We don't have to understand why we're doing this. I mean, you know, but we know what God said, which was, I've given you the city.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, you can only imagine how bizarre it must have been for everyone involved. But, you know, and like you said faithfulness, which back before we were talking about how courage and faithfulness go hand in hand. So excellent point there. What time is it? 10:17. You said 10 minutes before?
About 20 after.
20 after.
Close.
Okay. Well, we'll go for a little bit more. So part 4 of Joshua, I believe it's pronounced AI. Ai and Achan. So after this great defeat, or I guess conquering over Jericho, chapter 7 and verse 1, but the people of Israel broke faith in regard to the devoted things. And for Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, the tribe of Judah took some of the devoted things, and the anger of the Lord burned against the people of Israel. So I guess this is kind of time for maybe one or two more questions. Why did the anger of the Lord burn against all of the people of Israel instead of just Achan? He was the one that did the wrong thing. So why was everyone having to be put on trial for it? Yes, exactly. Because these people are in it together, right? They are all supposed to be together, taking on the promised land back with God on their side. And, you know, they're supposed to be a team unit. And if someone messes up, you need to make sure that everyone knows that this person messed up. And it's just, it's a way to keep people together and keep people more devoted to God. So I'll go ahead and summarize verses 2 through 9. So there's actually spies sent to go check out the land of Ai. And they come back and say for only 3,000 of them to go. They were kind of probably a little cocky here. They're saying, oh, we only need 3,000 soldiers to take on these guys. But because the anger of the Lord burned against the children of Israel, they were chased back and 36 actually died. So I guess the last question. So do you think that this overconfidence from the spies maybe played into their defeat a little bit? Or do you think it's only because of what Achan did? I know the Bible explicitly says that Achan was the main cause of this, but do you think there was a little bit of overconfidence here that maybe made God angry too? Or do you not think so?
They assumed, they didn't ask God. He told them to go forward. Here's, hey, we got this. We're going to do this rather than.
Right. Okay. Well, I had a lot more here, but unfortunately we are running out of time. So just to summarize, Joshua is a great book in the Bible to study. There's just passage after passage after passage of this extremely refreshing. I know we just got into a section where they weren't following so closely, but just a refreshing part of the Old Testament where the children of Israel were just following God to the letter and just making huge strides towards the will of God in the process. And after spending most of the start of the Old Testament just wanting to get to this point, and you're finally here and they're just mowing through all their enemies, it's super rewarding. And just to see the courage of Joshua displayed, Joshua was mentioned in the New Testament as well. He's a great role model. If you ever want to see more about courage, just keep on looking at Joshua. I didn't even mention this, but Joshua was actually probably around 80 something years old when he started his conquest into Canaan. And I don't know about you, but I don't know if I could lead a military conquest at 80 years old. That's impressive. But yeah, just if you ever want more inspiration, take a look at Joshua. If you guys want to talk to me about anything else after the class, go right ahead. But thank you, and I hope you enjoyed today's study.
Great job, brother.
Thank you.